www.ace.org.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Milwaukee Brewers, losers of 106 games last season, are on a pace to drop about 96 this year. The Brewers are currently 29-43. They're drawing an average crowd of 17,000 fans to their shiny new 41,000-seat stadium. The team has responded with a novel marketing strategy aimed at putting more backsides in those seats. Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Kornbach reports.
It's a pleasant June day in suburban Milwaukee. Brian Schauland and Russell First stroll from door to door. Their sales efforts are predictably hit and miss, and here in the conservative, church-going city of Brookfield, one homeowner mistakes the suit-clad salesman for Protestant proselytizers.
Hi. Hi there. How are you today?
I'm a Catholic. I'm fine. Thanks a lot. We'll see you.
Well, you have a good day, sir, okay?
Okay. Bye-bye.
Schauland and First are two of the 35 people who work for a private sales firm hired by the Brewers this spring. The sales crews sell $20 booklets that include two tickets and two-for-one deals on more expensive club seats. The Brewers have sold about 20,000 of the ticket packages so far this year. Not surprisingly, the sales pitches have centered around the Brewers' marketable, state-of-the-art ballpark.
Now the starting lineup for your Milwaukee Brewers.
Miller Park is only in its third year. The stadium is still a clean and comfortable place to watch a game. It's enough to keep fans like Bethany Wolfgram and Jeff Rieske coming back, despite the Brewers losing ways.
It's still baseball, still the major leagues. If the Brewers aren't doing well, some other team might be, and, you know, it's always good to see them, too.
I come because Richie Saxon is hot. I want to make out with him.
First baseman Richie Saxon has stepped up his on-field performance and apparently his sex appeal. But as the Brewers try to lure more than just die-hard or lovesick fans, there have been more gimmicks at Miller Park. Meet 19-year-old organist Dean Roscoe. He's the Brewers' first organist since 1987. Roscoe says he's been added this year to replace some of the piped-in music at the ballpark. He admits that the Brewers' sour notes have made it hard for him to create a happy atmosphere.
It makes my job a little bit more, I guess you could say demanding. I don't know if that's exactly the right word for it, but it makes the job more difficult because you have to work harder to get people into it.
Orchestrating the changes in the Brewers organization is the team's new president and CEO, Ulyss Payne. Payne took over this year from Wendy Selig Priebe, the daughter of baseball commissioner Bud Selig. Payne makes no excuses for the Brewers' sorry record and sliding attendance. He says the franchise plans to hang in there.
We're being candid with the fans. We're not telling them a story that they want to hear. We're telling them it's going to take a while. We can't say how long, but I think we are planning for a long-term viable plan. We're not looking at a short-term situation here.
Okay, how much is it here?
It's only $20.
Back in the well-to-do suburbs, door-to-door ticket seller Russell First finds a fan who believes the Brewers are going in the right direction. Dan Kaufman has gone to many games, but he decides to buy the extra ticket package anyway. Kaufman still remembers the only time the Brewers headed to the World Series.
You know, I go back in my heydays when, you know, back in 82, and I was on the field in 82, you know, jumping over the fence, congratulating, and all those are fun. Let's hope we get back to those times. As long as they're competitive and they're trying, they're making an effort, I'll continue to watch baseball.
Kaufman acknowledges it may be a while before the Brewers return to their 1982 form. But for now, the late disco era lives on at Miller Park, despite the Brewers' losing record. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
The This year's NBA draft will, as usual, include lots of underclassmen, high schoolers, overhyped future washouts, and underhyped stars to be. But unless the series of choices takes a very unexpected turn, there will be legions of foreign hoopsters booking flights to their respective NBA cities come June the 26th. Joining me now on the line to discuss this year's NBA xenophilia is CBS Sportsline columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bill.
After having perused at least 93 mock drafts, maybe it's 94, I see that players from Serbia, Montenegro, Poland, Greece, France, Argentina, Brazil, Croatia, and Slovenia are being seriously considered by NBA teams this year. But they are no longer considering a certain 7'5" Siberian. What happened with Pavel Poldkolzin?
Well, he decided that unless he was going to be guaranteed a pick, he was going to head back to his Italian pro team and work on it. He's young, and he has a lot of time to develop. And he was, unlike just about every American kid coming down the pipe, was not interested in rushing his way to the NBA. It was the draft shocker, though. This guy was almost everyone believed was going to go in the top 10, and now he's going to have to wait another year where he will develop and get going.
Players from Russia aren't exactly new to the NBA, but several of the other nations I mentioned before haven't exactly developed a lot of NBA-caliber talent in the past. What's changed over the last few years to create what could very well be a huge influx of overseas players this year?
Well, there's definitely going to be an influx. It's turned into one of those James Bond movies where we have the Alexanders and the Darkos and the Victors and all these guys. And so it's adding a lot of intrigue to the draft. You never know what these guys are going to do. But really, the genesis of this begins back in 1992 when they put together the original Dream Team. They played in Barcelona, and kids all over the world watched this thing and said, wow, that's great. If you look at it, that was 11 years ago, so these 18-year-olds were seven, and they started playing basketball. They started wanting to be like Mike, and 11 years later, they're all here. And it doesn't matter where you play. The player we were just talking about, Pavel Podkolzin, once they're going all the way to Siberia to find guys, we officially are, until there's a point guard from Antarctica with a great crossover, I guess then we're finally the world's game.
The current NBA teams known for taking chances on foreign players are, for the most part, from the Western Conference. Will Dallas, Sacramento, and San Antonio continue with this trend, or do we see now the Eastern Conference counterparts getting in on the action?
At this point, everybody is in, because if you look at the Spurs that just won the title, they had Tim Duncan from the Virgin Islands, Tony Parker from France, Emmanuel Ginobili from Argentina. So all 29 teams now have at least one scout in Europe, and often two scouts in Europe. If you look at this draft, we're talking 12 to 13 guys from overseas are going to be drafted in the first round. That's almost half of the first round. So you need to spend half your time scouting overseas and not just pouring all your resources into looking at American colleges.
How does the scouting overseas work? I mean, these guys, do the scouts know about the caliber of competition? They see these guys play, but it's not like seeing, Duke play UNC.
Well, it's different. There's no question. There can be a different intensity, and the desire to win the games can be different. But at the same time, you can see a lot out of it, especially these young guys. You take the number two pick, Darko Milicic. He's only 17. He's often playing with 26, 28, 30-year-old men. So even though they may not be the best players, they can be very good, and they give him a physical challenge. And a lot of times, some of those guys, most of those teams in Europe have former college stars that are now 2, 3, 4, 5 years out of college. So they are pretty good. And really, it's about skills at this point. It's about how much ability you have, and you can scout pretty well from here. And at this point, you can watch a Darko. You can watch this Pavel guy if he had stayed in the draft at 7'5", 300 and say, this is a pretty good player.
Or at least he's pretty close to the basket.
He has a 9'8" reach. He just can stand there and dunk it.
You mentioned that Milicic might very well have been the number one pick if it weren't for LeBron James. What happens to the basketball establishment here when the first pick is somebody from Siberia and the second pick is somebody from Italy and the next guy is from Croatia? I mean, do the college coaches all sort of wonder what they're doing wrong?
there's part of it in what we're doing, what the United States basketball is doing wrong, but I certainly believe USA basketball, particularly with the struggles we've had in international competition and the system we have for developing players, is very different than the one in Europe. Milicic turned pro at 15 to help feed his family.
Mm-hmm.
He spends 6 to 7 hours a day in the gym working on skills. School, and we're talking high school, is not that important to him. And the shoe is on the other foot, where maybe the best place to develop as a player, if all you care about is being a player, is in Europe and not the United States, where we still want you to go to school, we limit your practice times, we limit the number of games you can play.
Given the presence of so many players from so many different places, what sort of play is Thursday's draft going to get in the countries where these players live?
Well, it's significant, and as much as it's a celebration when a local player makes the NBA in this country, it's even bigger in foreign countries because the odds just seem so much longer. You know, if you're from New York and you're a great player, you can play in the NBA. That dream was not always available if you're from Poland or something.
Hmm.
So it's going to be a big deal, and it's part of David Stern's philosophy is the globalization of the game. Obviously, the United States television ratings for the NBA Finals were dreadful. They're off almost two-thirds in the last 5 years. But they can counter and say, they were able to broadcast the finals into China. They were able to broadcast them all over Europe and in France and things like this, where a lot of the players are from. It's growing in popularity. So it's a give and take.
Dan Wetzel covers the NBA draft and other matters as well for CBS Sportsline. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Gone, gone, gone with the draft. Gone, gone, gone with the draft. Gone, gone, gone with the draft. When Skinny me went out with my honey, the boys all started to laugh. But now it's not so funny. They're all gone with the draft. As a sheep, I can't be beat. The boys all hand me a laugh. But since I have got flat feet, I'm not gone with the draft.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
High on the hill was a lonely goat herd. Lay, oddlay, oddlay.
Times have been hard for Mystic, Iowa. Once known for coal production, Mystic has seen its population decline from over 3,000 folks to about 600 today. Gone are the school, the stores, and the crowds that once filled Mystic streets, or street at least, for the Berg's annual 4th of July celebration. In an attempt to revive that tradition, the Mystic Booster Club will bring goat racing to town on the 4th this year. Promoters of the event believe they will attract competitors and spectators from all over Iowa. The rules of the contest require a goat jockey to run barefoot behind each animal with a stick to keep it on course, and anyone swatting his or her goat will be disqualified. Good seats are still available, probably.
I'm Dolores Handy with these sports headlines. In yesterday's interleague play, the White Sox downed the Cubs 12-3. Toronto doubled up Montreal 8-4. The Yankees blanked the Mets 5-0. And Atlanta bested Baltimore 6-3. Elsewhere, Florida foiled Tampa Bay 3-1. Milwaukee edged Minnesota 3-2. And the game between Boston and Philadelphia was postponed as there was weather. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, young sliders pursue mastery of the luge without benefit of ice. But first, for most of his tenure as baseball's commissioner, Bud Selig has stridently maintained that the teams with revenue trickles rather than revenue streams cannot compete. For the last several years, Billy Beane, the general manager of the utterly strapped and decidedly competitive Oakland Athletics, has been making the commissioner look like a dope. That situation so fascinated Michael Lewis that he decided to write a book about Billy Beane's achievement. The result is called Moneyball. Michael Lewis joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, well, a pleasure to be here.
You say in the preface of this book that you undertook the project because you were fascinated that the Oakland Athletics seemed to be playing a different game from all the other major league teams. Does that really turn out to be the case?
In a sense, they are playing baseball. It's not football or anything like that. So in that sense, no. But in the sense that the way they were coping with the fact they had no money was to rethink the game from the ground up, to see if they could find inefficiencies in the way it was played on the field and the way players were valued. They were systematically looking for new baseball knowledge and trying to find a better way of playing. And so in that sense, yes, they were playing a different game.
Oakland's general manager, Billy Beane, figured out that the standard methods of rating players were at best inefficient and at worst dumb and flat out wrong. He'd been a player. Was that part of the reason he came to that conclusion?
He'd been a player who'd been idiotically valued. He was in 1980 maybe the hottest high school prospect in the country. He could run fast. He was big. He had a body you could dream on, is what the scouts would say about him.
Mm-hmm.
He had the good face. The scouts had this expression called the good face. And, phrenology died last in baseball. The idea that you could sort of determine how a young man would perform, you know, based on his facial structure. But he had the tools. You know, they break a young man down like you'd break a car down. And the problem was he couldn't hit. But they didn't pick that up because they didn't look that close.
He looked like he should be.
He was a great athlete who, when he got in a batter's box, just couldn't cope. And he spent 10 miserable years bouncing around the minor leagues and benches of big league ball clubs before he just gave up at age 27. So he knew in his bones that what scouts found desirable was not necessarily actually desirable. And as a result, what scouts found undesirable might be desirable.
So Beane has been winning games with less expensive players in Oakland for several years now. Why haven't more general managers and scouting directors and scouts, for that matter, in other major league organizations followed his lead?
Some teams are imitating the Oakland A's. The Toronto Blue Jays and the Boston Red Sox have more or less explicitly said that they're reinventing their organizations along these lines. But baseball is very resistant to change. I mean, the reason there were these inefficiencies in the game in the first place is that people tend to do things the way they've always been done. And the Oakland A's get a lot of grief for trying to do things differently. I mean, there's a lot of friction in the system.
Even within the Oakland system. There are a lot of people who Beane, you know, he was a dirty word among the scouts in Oakland when he started out.
This is a story, among other things, of a man in constant conflict with his environment because it's so difficult for him to do anything different or new. Because Oakland hasn't won a World Series, and the World Series is regarded in baseball as the measure of success, rather than consistently putting a great team on the field with no money and getting to the playoffs, baseball people can tell themselves that these people in Oakland haven't accomplished all that much.
Well, that is, of course, the one hitch in Beane's strategy. It depends on logic working itself out over time, and the playoffs and the World Series just don't give teams the time for the dice to roll as they will inevitably finally roll.
Right. I mean, essentially, the Oakland A's try to set themselves up as the casino. And if you come into that casino and you pull the slot 6,000 times, they're going to win. But if you come into the casino and pull the slot once or twice, you may walk away with a jackpot, right? I mean, that is what they're playing, a game of probabilities. And all they can do, in their view, is get the team to the playoffs. The one thing you can do, they say, to make a team more playoff ready is to have three great starting pitchers. And they have that. So I think it's just a matter of time. You get them to the playoffs enough and they will be a success.
One of the qualities that Beane and those who've followed in his wake most value in a hitter is patience. And the exercising of patience by Scott Hatteberg, one of Beane's finds when he's hitting against Seattle's Jamie Moyer, provides you with a wonderful story.
It was a wonderful story. Hatteberg was facing in many ways his antithesis, or his equivalent on the mound, Moyer, this very crafty pitcher who didn't have a lot of flashy stuff, but who was extremely effective and fed on opponents' aggressions, that he required the hitter to go after pitches on the edge of the strike zone. And Hatterberg's gift was not doing that. This was at the end of a game in the Oakland Coliseum. The A's were winning 1-0. It was in the eighth inning. They were winning 1-0 because Hatterberg had hit a home run off of Moyer. And Moyer faces Hatterberg, and throws him six or seven pitches. The count is full. Hatterberg's fouling off pitches. And finally, Moyer just steps off the mound and shouts something to Hatterberg. And Hatterberg had never had a pitcher talk to him in the middle of a game. So he steps out the batter's box. He says, what? And Moyer says, what do you want? And Hatterberg said, what do you mean? He says, tell me what you want and I'll throw it. And
he was tired of me at that.
But this is exactly the effect that Billy Beane wants his hitters to have on opposing pitchers. Tell me what you want and I'll throw it. I'm so tired of having to each of these at-bats be these soap operas that I just want to get it over with. And if you build a lineup of guys like this, the starting pitcher doesn't last past the fourth inning. I mean, even if he's throwing rather well, the hitters string him out so much that his pitch counts go up and they get into the bullpen. And the bullpen's the bullpen because they're the second string.
Right.
Now, this is one of the traits that the A's have identified in hitters, patience, composure, selectivity, whatever you want to call it, that they have found is really undervalued in the marketplace. You can go and buy it rather cheaply, and it's very important. So that's where they go buy.
And one of the things they've found is one of the reasons you can buy people with the traits they value rather cheaply is sometimes the people with those traits are fat or slow or ugly, and they don't look like ball players, and Oakland just doesn't care.
As Billy Beane's deputy, Paul DePodesta, a young Harvard graduate, said to me after I'd been there a few weeks, what you have to understand about this team is that for a player to become an Oakland A, he has to have something wrong with him. He has to be defective in some way.
Something grotesque, because that will put off the scouts of the other team.
That's right, because if he doesn't have something wrong with him, he'll be valued properly, and we can't afford him. Mm-hmm. So that's what you were asked what really pulled me into the story. It was this wonderful notion. You had this collection of defective parts that was an absolute juggernaut. Or not on the field, playing against all these slick superstars. And I thought that was just a wonderful story.
Billy Beane's trades have been almost as successful as his signings have been, his draft signings. General managers around the league must hate it when the phone rings and it's Billy Beane on the other end, because even if they can't figure out how he's outfoxing them, they know it's about to happen, right?
I mean, I think that a number of them think he's a witch. They don't understand why it happens over and over, but every time he gets this, the deal looks great for him and not so good for them. And it isn't because he's doing anything deceitful. He just knows things about the players they don't know. And I think what's happened is that several of the general managers with whom he's dealt have more or less decided we just don't do business with Billy because it doesn't end well. And that's the Tampa Bay team, the Devil Rays. I know they won't pick up the phone. I think the Royals have some trepidation, maybe even the White Sox now. But there are, surprisingly, a number of general managers who are still happy to do business with the A's, and I would have thought they would have learned. But for the same reason, they don't set out to figure out what the A's are doing and replicate it in their own organizations. They're willing to do business with the A's because they think they don't know anything they don't know.
Michael Lewis is the author of Moneyball, published by Norton. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's been great.
Many Olympic gymnasts tumble before they toddle. Figure skaters often twirl before they teethe, but how do athletes in more obscure sports get their starts? Only a Game's Karen Given recently attended one recruiting session, and she has this report.
All right. Just in case you don't know, luge is a winter Olympic sport. We take sleds, very similar to this, down an icy course.
More than a dozen kids, aged 10 to 14, stand at attention for luge coach and former slider Pete Mata on a warm and humid Saturday afternoon at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston. These kids and their parents have come here, some from as far as 4 hours away, to try to become the next members of the U.S. luge team.
This is also a way for us to recruit new athletes, okay? So if we see something we like out of some of you guys today, you might find yourself up in Lake Placid this winter trying it out on ice.
By the end of the summer, the slider search will have traveled to 7 cities, from Long Island to Los Angeles, and taken between 600 to 1,000 kids on a ride down the street on a luge fitted with rollerblade wheels. In the past, most elite sliders grew up near a track, where they could try the sport early and often. But most of today's athletes are being discovered at slider searches like this one, including 6 members of the 2002 Olympic team. Pete Mata, also a graduate of the search, says the unorthodox event is vital for an obscure sport like luge.
We can't, you know, sit around in Lake Placid and wait for people to come to us, you know, because we'll have five kids a year trying out for the team, so we have to force feed luge to kids. Legs up nice and high. All right, show me a turn that way.
Mata and reigning junior world champion Yukio Grifol test each slider's understanding of the sled before anyone actually gets rolling.
All right, let's get some helmets and go do some sliding.
As the kids grab their gear, they look excited but not intimidated. After all, they watched luge during the Salt Lake Olympics, where the track was a mile long and produced speeds of more than 90 miles per hour. This track is the length of a football field. And, as Mata freely admits, most kids get more speed on their bikes than they will today.
Kids come out and, you know, we only give them 6 or 7 runs because they kind of get bored after it. Because these days kids do crazier stuff all the time than this. So it's tough to keep their interest on the hill. But once they get up on ice, there's more than enough to hold their interest.
For the first few runs, the prospective sliders begin midway up the hill, where Yukio Grifol offers last-minute advice before sending them down one at a time. Many of the kids have the same question.
How fast do you think we're going down this hill?
Oh, at least 80.
Okay. No,
I don't know.
The sleds don't go very fast at first, but as the group moves up the hill to finally start from the top of a 6-foot ramp, smiles grow significantly wider. No smile is bigger than Emily Sweeney's. At 10 years old, this is her first chance to try out for the team, but she's been looking forward to getting on a sled for years.
My sister's on the team. I like fast stuff.
Is it everything you expected it to be?
Yes. It's more. I like it.
Have fun.
Thank you.
Midway down the hill, the aforementioned sister and junior national team slider, 16-year-old Megan Sweeney, isn't surprised to watch Emily confidently speed down the track.
We all love speed in the family, and she's doing very well. They're all doing very well, but she's doing the best. No, she's... Speaking, of yes.
Good.
Later today, the sleds will be put aside for chin-ups, standing long jumps, and a battery of other physical tests. But right now, Larry Dolan and the other athletes and coaches are looking for kids who have a natural feel for the sled and who enjoy speed. Because while luge might look like an easy sport to learn, successful sliders start young.
When you start as a child, you're not afraid of the speed. If you start later, they have to adjust to the speed, and that can be an issue, especially for the adults. You know, you'll see a lot of adults come out and try it, and wow, you know, they'll be going from a low start. They'll be like, that's so fast, you know, but you're only going 40 miles an hour. Tops. You're in a speed zone, you know.
The luge slider search will be in New Brunswick, New Jersey today before moving on to Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, and Denver. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Kingston, Rhode Island.
You're listening to Only a Game. A listener named Chris, who hears Only a Game on WHYY in Philadelphia, wrote this week to say thanks so much for last week's segment on Greg Luzinski. The big question is, where did you get that trumpet music with the cows mooing? We ended actor Charlie Schroeder's piece with Herb Albert's The Lonely Bull, as played by Cuds and Roses, on a silly compact disc entitled Barnyard Beat. Bill Caldwell, a WBUR listener, offered a correction of a story on last week's show. You led off your excellent piece on Cal Eldred by saying it was Tuesday night and the rain was pouring down, Mr. Caldwell wrote. I took Tuesday off because it was 85 degrees and gorgeous. I think you must have spoken to Mr. Eldred on another day. He's right. It was Wednesday. I goofed. Regarding a piece that ran all of 45 seconds last week, Paul Riza, who hears the show on KPBS in San Diego, wrote, "I am a loyal listener, but I'm very disappointed that you would waste any time on the trivial and inane story of the couple who made a decision to marry based on the outcome of the Anaheim Ducks season. Who are these folks, and why should anybody care about them? P.S. The couple will probably be divorced before the Ducks get back to the Stanley Cup Finals." Charlie Pierce's comments on the French Open 2 weeks ago irked Jeff Berg, who hears only a game on WRNI in Rhode Island. "Winning on clay tests the diversity of a champion," he wrote. "I think Charlie Pierce's problem is not with the surface, but with his chauvinism." On the other hand, WBUR listener Jeff Turton emailed to celebrate Charlie's contention that the significance of the Sammy Sosa corked bat incident had been exaggerated. "Thank God for Charlie Pierce," he wrote, one of the few intelligent voices in sports commentary. Finally, Barbara Schaefer, who hears the program on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, wrote to urge us to attend this year's Mud Volleyball Tournament in Columbus. You can suggest where we should go and what we should do there, too. The email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can get in touch with us through the website, onlyagame.org. We live at WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senior citizens dance in Miami's Little Havana. Horns blare in the bombed-out streets of Kosovo. And steel drums ring below Broadway and a New York subway platform. I'm Scott Simon. These sounds of our world on Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News.
I'm Dolores Handy with the sports headlines. In more of yesterday's interleague play, Houston topped Texas 12-3. Kansas City stymied St. Louis 10-4. Detroit beat Colorado 7-5. And Oakland vanquished San Francisco 5-3. Elsewhere, Arizona edged Cincinnati 6-5. San Diego stopped Seattle 5-3. And Los Angeles overcame Anaheim 5-2. For Only a Game, I'm Dolores Handy in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Larry Doby remembered. But first, my weekly discussion of the sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce, who joins me this week from Portland, Oregon. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
NASCAR, your favorite fastest, if not fastest growing spectator sport, has a new name sponsor. Have you acquired a NASCAR Nextel Cup Series t-shirt yet?
This is a very, very interesting development, and it's the best indication yet of the growth and reach of NASCAR over the last several years. They have now completely divorced themselves from their southern rural roots by abandoning, you know, a sponsor, Winston, which is derived from the best, if most controversial, product of that region, tobacco, and attaching itself to a globalized wireless communication firm, mm-hmm. which is an indication that NASCAR has not only left the South but gone up market. And I find that very interesting.
Sammy Sosa returned to the Cubs on Wednesday, having served his 7-game suspension, and he immediately hit a home run. Maybe all he needed was a week off.
Yeah, he also was booed, which was sort of a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
He also broke a bat, which I'm sure caused the whole ballpark to go, oh!
On Thursday, Charlie, an independent commission proposed drastic changes for the United States Olympic Committee. Specifically, the board of directors would be pared down from 124 to 9, and the committee would be required to report to Congress once each year. What do you think? Just take care of everything?
Find a little fat in the operation today? I don't know that will be that radical a change that will make, you know, the committee less unwieldy and probably easier to investigate, which I guess is a good thing.
This week, Tiger Woods bristled at the contention that he might be in a slump. But, I mean, isn't he? He since winning 3 of the first 4 tournaments he entered this year, he's been essentially mortal, right?
Yeah, he's in a period of his career where he's not being Tiger Woods. He's in a period of his career where he's not being the greatest golfer who ever lived. If you go back through history, though, you will discover that Jack Nicklaus went through the same kind of sort of flack period at roughly the same age as Tiger Woods is going through, and of course rallied to become the greatest golfer before Tiger Woods. And I'm sort of agreeing with my old friend Tiger in this one that, you know, the only way he is in a slump is in the perfectly relative sense that he's Tiger Woods.
So what does he have to do to convince people that he's gotten out of a slump? Win 3 out of 4 at some point?
I think the way he will, the only way to silence all of the people who believe he's in a slump is to win either the British Open or the PGA, one of the last remaining majors. If he wins a bunch of Buicks and a bunch of Dorals and a bunch of week-to-week tournament, which he doesn't play in a lot right now, by the way, anyway, I don't think that will wholly do it. But if he goes out and wins the British Open, that'll do it.
He is competing in the Buick Classic this week. The Buick Classic, how many years does a tournament have to exist before it gets to be a classic? This one began, I think, 14 years ago.
Well, they are classics at birth because they declare themselves to be. The Buick Classic, of course, is a sponsor tournament for Tiger, who's been allied with Buick for as long as he's been on the tour. I recall very clearly, though, that was the way you marketed a sports event back when I was a child,
mm-hmm.
is that you had the Sugar Bowl Classic, which was a football game, or the Holiday Classic, which was a basketball tournament, and here you have the Buick Classic.
Speaking of golf, the security at the U.S. Open came into question this week when it turned out that William League Jr., the guy arrested for attacking Kansas City Royals first base coach Charlie Gamboa in Chicago last year, was on the course last week as a member of the cleaning staff. Maybe he left blank the line on the application after, "Have you ever been arrested?"
Well, I'm not sure, except that he seemed to be working in the hospitality area, which I found a little ironic.
Yeah, he swears he's a changed man and nobody had anything
to
worry about.
He's on his way to the Hoosgow, too. I mean, he's out pending sentencing.
Right, exactly. On Thursday, Pavel Podkolzin, the 7'5" Siberian with a pituitary disorder, announced that he will return to play pro basketball in Italy rather than take part in Thursday's NBA draft. I don't know what's more surprising, that a man 7'5" has a pituitary problem or that he'll turn down the NBA cash for the year.
Well, I mean, the one thing that isn't surprising about this story is that a man from Siberia would rather play in Italy than perhaps Denver or Detroit, which would remind him, I think, a little bit too much of home.
The idea here is he or his agent is saying that he will become a better player, a more valuable player, as a result of one more year of experience in Italy. But this is a little hard to believe, isn't it? Wouldn't he be better off at the end of an NBA bench?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, he will play a lot in Italy. He will be paid very well. It's not an entirely unpleasant place to spend your life, and perhaps he really doesn't want to be the end of the bench, which would make him very unusual among the various foreigners and high schoolers who make up the draft this year.
Throughout the NBA, the annual dance of the coaches has been continuing. Have you a favorite, inevitably temporary matchup of coach with franchise to note?
Well, I have my favorite former Marquette University lunatic, Kevin O'Neill, going to Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Mike Dunleavy, who has a perfectly wonderful record as an NBA coach, which he's going to throw down the drain by taking the Clippers job.
Well, somebody has to do it, I guess, right?
I think it would be very interesting if we just let the Clippers play without a coach this year to see if that will work. We've tried everything else. I think we should see if this year we'll try without a coach. Next year we'll try without their crazy owner. And maybe a year after that we'll try it without players and see what we do.
This week, the Orlando Magic announced that Grant Hill probably will not play at all next season. He's undergone his fourth ankle surgery. They added that Hill does not plan to retire. Now, considering that Hill has missed about 250 games over his 9-year career, is there any chance that he comes back year after this coming year?
Well, it seems like he's been taking his retirement in tiny bits throughout his career. But, this is a really sad story. I mean, he has exactly the same sort of thing that plagued Bill Walton at the end of his career,
mm-hmm.
which is he has these brittle, as we all know from high school anatomy, there are a lot of bones in the human ankle and the human foot, and most of Grant Hill's are brittle, and having broken one or two of them, they've compromised everything else, and a guy who people thought was going to be the next Michael Jordan is simply another brittle basketball player.
Finally, Charlie, you might want to choose somewhere other than Birmingham, England, to get sick if you're a difficult patient.
The hospital, it was way down my list, by the way.
Well, the hospital there has been giving impolite patients yellow cards, and those who are genuinely obstreperous get red cards. I wonder if they get thrown off the ward.
I just have this vision of this doctor in full greens running up the side of your bed and holding up his hand and showing it to the other patients. If they throw you out and you're very sick and you have to go to another hospital, does the first hospital get a transfer fee?
Yeah, and you have to stay out for two games before you can go back in, too. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He's the resident card here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Lots of current ball players face all sorts of challenges. It's easy to root for the ones trying to make it back after injuries or those in recovery from drug addiction or alcoholism, the latter condition until fairly recently assumed to be a work-related perk for ballplayers rather than a disease. Then there's the struggle the most courageous of them wage to escape perpetual adolescence. As former Major League pitcher Bill Lee once put it, most of baseball is sitting around spitting and laughing at stupid things. It's easy for at least the most fortunate major leaguers to keep adulthood at bay for whole decades. Larry Doby, who died at the age of 78 on Wednesday, didn't have that luxury. In 1947, as the first black player in the American League, Doby endured insults and abuse, and like Jackie Robinson in the National League, he could not respond to the thugs, yahoos, and morons responsible. Years later, Doby acknowledged the pain. "The things I was called did hurt me," he said. "The things people did to me, spitting tobacco juice on me, sliding into me, throwing baseballs at my head. I was raised to respect people. I found out that all people are not raised that way." Like Robinson, Doby found hostility even in the clubhouse of the team that employed him. Like Robinson, he played brilliantly anyway, earning a spot on the All-Star team 7 years in a row, leading the league in on-base percentage once, runs batted in once, and home runs twice. He hit .318 in the 1948 World Series, helping the Indians to the most recent championship the team has won. In 1950, the Sporting News ranked him ahead of Joe DiMaggio and Duke Snyder as a center fielder. Doby was elected to the Hall of Fame in 1998 by the Veterans Committee. But he was second. "You didn't hear much about what I was going through," he said years later, "because the media didn't want to repeat the same story." The story belonged to Jackie Robinson. Ironically, Doby was also the second black manager in the major leagues. His tenure in 1978 at the end of the bench for the White Sox was short and undistinguished, but for one neat coincidence. One of the players on the Chicago bench that year was Cleveland native Larry Doby Johnson, who obviously had been named for the first black player in the American League. The journeyman catcher only played in 3 games, but his presence must have been a gratifying reminder that 30 years earlier, somebody had decided to honor the achievement of one of baseball's determined pioneers.
Doby and outfield, letting nothing get by. Jackie hitting so safe, you swear the ball, and I don't care. Time has really come. Cleveland got Larry Doby. Brooklyn's got Jackie Robinson. Grandpa looking at television, pulling a whisker on his chin. He hollered real loud, Jackie done it again. Big Red, time has really come. Cleveland got Larry Doby. Brooklyn's got Jackie Robinson. He knocked the ball out of the park, but let me tell you the news. When the man brought the ball back in the wheels on his shoes.
This weekend, Indy Racing League drivers will test their reflexes and stamina in the SunTrust Indy Challenge at Virginia's Richmond International Raceway. Last week, a few IRL drivers tested the same attributes at the invitation of USA Triathlon, which helped them experience a day in the life of triathletes at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. Only a Game's Nancy Greenlease has this report.
Early on a Wednesday morning in Colorado, three race car drivers huddle near an Olympic-sized pool and peer at it apprehensively. These gentlemen aren't ready to start their engines and try out this new race course until U.S. Triathlon swim coach Mike Doan finally gives them a nudge.
We're going to get in lane five and start with a 100-meter warm-up. And I'll watch you swim and we'll decide if we get out life support and go from there.
Drivers Ari Lyandike Jr. and Buddy Rice wear colorful knee-length board shorts, but no goggles. Brazilian driver Vitor Mira wears a skimpy black swimsuit. As the three begin the first stage of their training, arms flail and water sloshes, making the pool look like an oversized washing machine.
How was it?
Longer than most pools.
Here, let me explain what the triathletes did this morning so you can kind of put things in perspective. You guys just did 100 meters, and they're just finishing off a 5,000-meter workout.
Converted into imperial measurements, that means the triathletes have swum more than 3 miles to the drivers' 110 yards. But these Indy Racing League drivers are driven. They undergo a critique and continue on to kicking drills and challenge two elite female athletes to a 50-meter race. The men wear fins, the women use their own feet. The drivers chop through the water while the women easily glide along. Tall and lean triathlete Susie Gallucci, who lives and trains at the Olympic Training Center, wins by half a body length.
30.3, so you got faster.
Nice job!
33 flat. You guys improved, you got better.
You were kidding.
But the novices aren't convinced. Dripping wet, everyone gathers on the deck. Vitor Mira, who tied for second, participates in triathlons as a hobby.
I can't believe you guys do this every day. You do this every day?
It's kind of impartial.
Not sprinting.
Oh. Yeah. Notice you don't see any cars around.
Yeah, we're not getting behind the wheel.
Do we get to drive your cars?
Yeah, that'd be pretty much embarrassing for us, I think.
Probably not a good idea.
As the training session continues, the triathletes and drivers discover they have much in common. Both endure races lasting many hours, which require quick reflexes and strategic thinking. The races are far more than a test of their engines. When a driver takes a corner 4 times his body weight is pressed against him. Shoulders, arms, necks, and the legs tire quickly. Indy driver Thomas Schechter says racing requires a high level of athleticism.
I've known many, many drivers after a race to be stuck on IVs because they've lost so much fluid. I mean, you'll get an overall after my race and it is soaking wet, and we'll race in whatever temperatures for 3 to 4 hours. So it's not only physically draining, it's mentally, you have to be mentally alert all the time.
In fact, Schechter was concerned that today's training would overexert him, so he opted out.
All right, now just bring the bar down a little further. That's it, keep that back tight though. There you go, perfect. Now just boom, explode out. Well, good, pretty good.
Later in the day, the drivers lift in the Olympic Training Center's weight room. They normally do lightweight repetitions to build up endurance. Today, they do sit-ups and agility training that resembles hopscotch.
Move it, move it, move it, move it!
earlier generations of drivers didn't put a premium on physical conditioning. Ari Leyendijk Jr. is the son of a two-time Indy 500 winner. The 21-year-old says Dad isn't wild about his strenuous workouts.
He thinks I go overboard sometimes too much. I used to actually run before my race or run, you know, before morning practice. I used to get up every morning and run, and I think that was a little too much.
Ari prepares for his third workout of the day, the run. The triathletes and drivers warm up, hopping, skipping, and sidestepping along a gravel path near Fountain Creek.
Susie, you ready?
My bat!
Let's hit it, guys.
They go over the creek and through the woods for nearly an hour. After the run, triathlete Seth Wheeling expresses his admiration for the Indy drivers.
They could have done archery or something at the Olympic Training Center or something easier, as I would say, but they really chose to do the kind of the hardest thing, and that's pretty commendable. I'm pretty impressed.
The day left such an impression on Vitor that he began asking about a return visit. Three workouts totaling about 6 hours, and he's ready for more.
I want to come back here for intensive training. I can add a lot on my training in my sport.
As a race car driver or as a triathlete?
It's an athlete. It's a sportman. Generally.
For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
With a little bit of action, you can be doing a swim now. Just move like a fish and wiggle right up to him now.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or Luge with the Youngsters. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from triathlete Susie Gallucci, who issues the following challenge to Indy Racing League drivers.
Give me the biggest, baddest, meanest, you know, toughest driver that there is out there, and I'll race him. And he can pick the event and wear fins.
Susie, everybody knows there's no way to wear fins and work the gas and clutch pedals in an Indy car. That's just silly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is
8-BICON.
This is